This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, this is Jeanette Lefebvre, your guest host tonight on the People Speak Radio, filling in for Bessema Farhat. At the People Speak, we believe that the voices and actions of ordinary people make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak at bbsradio.com, live every Tuesday night from 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. You can also log into our website at thepeoplespeakradio.com to listen to us live, join us through our live chat on Pal Talk, or listen to the archives of previous shows. If you have questions for the guest, you may call in toll-free in the USA and Canada at 1-888-429-5471. Or on Skype, BBS Radio, identify your location and give a first name. Make sure to turn down your speakers or there will be feedback. Okay. Let me jump around here. Now, tonight we have with us Dr. Gudrun Björk. She's a licensed psychoanalyst and psychologist from Sweden. Although Dr. Björk is here to discuss her experiences in her work with Doctors Without Borders in Hebron, Palestine, we do want listeners to understand that she is not speaking on behalf of the organization she worked for. She is speaking as a witness to the events in the West Bank and Palestine, and she is speaking as a professional explaining the impact of these events on the general population there. I want to thank you, Dr. Björk, for agreeing to talk with us tonight. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Now, we understand that you were in Hebron. I'm not real clear on how long you were there or when you were there. Would you?
Yes, I was there for 9 months, from August last year till May this year.
Okay, now, why is it you went to Palestine?
Yeah, why does anyone go to the field with Doctors Without Borders? That's, I think, a very personal question. For me, it was, for me personally, an opportunity to learn about the situation on the West Bank and Palestine. And hopefully also to do some work, of course.
Okay, and what kind of work, what were going to be your responsibilities working with the population?
Well, Doctors Without Borders has 3 projects in Palestine, one in Hebron, where I was, one in Gaza, and in Nablus, north of West Bank. And these are mental health projects. And in Hebron, there has MSF, Doctors Without Borders, has been there since, 1996, 15, 16 years or something like that. And since 2001 or 2, maybe, I'm not exactly sure here, there is only a mental health project. So I went to Palestine to work with people who have been traumatized by the conflict. So that's the target population for Doctors Without Borders in Hebron is people who have been traumatized by the conflict.
Now, in your experience, first of all, would you mind, and don't go into any more detail than you're comfortable with, describing some of the traumas that these people are experiencing firsthand on a day-to-day basis?
What people are living with since the occupation of the West Bank is daily roadblocks, checkpoints, fixed and flying checkpoints, incursions, usually in the night, land confiscation, meter by meter, every day, There are house demolitions going on every day. There are people arrested daily. Yeah, that's the short list of what's going on.
Now, our earlier discussions, we were discussing the fact that every action taken, there's a physical impact, but that the psychological impact is a high level of psychological warfare. And we were talking about a particular aspect of the psychological warfare involved going into homes and making arrests in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
Could you describe, first of all, the situation, what happens, and then what the impact on the people involved is?
Well, these incursions and arrests are happening usually in the night time, in the dead of the night, between 1 or 3 in the morning. And what happens then is that it could be many, many soldiers with dogs, M16s, bursting into the house or calling people out in the middle of the night, the whole family, extended families often live together in the houses. Could be that two or three members of the family, or maybe all men and young boys, are arrested, taken away. Of course, the family doesn't know where they are taken. It could be that they are released within a few days or weeks, months, or even years. Now, the situation there is with the, since last year, the Israeli, according to Israeli law, a Palestinian can be arrested, held for 1 year before they have the right to see a lawyer or even to be presented with a charge. And the impact is, well, of course, the children are suffering doubly, or affected doubly from this. Firstly, their own experience, of course, of the incursions, witnessing family members being beaten up, because there is also, these incursions are usually very violent. Sometimes even the women and children are beaten. So that's one effect or from their experience. The second effect is, of course, also that the parents or caregivers are traumatized. So in that sense, I feel that the children, they are affected doubly.
Now you mentioned they arrest all the men and the young men and the young boys in the house. How young of children do they take out during these incursions?
7, 8-year-old boys I have heard of. So it's a great many children, young children, are arrested and could be held in detention for a few weeks, maybe months.
Now, something that I want to go back to, you mentioned that they can be held under Israeli law up to a year without even the right to see a lawyer. Now,
yeah.
We hear a great deal about the Israeli soldier being held in Gaza being denied the right to see the Red Cross. Are these prisoners at least allowed to see the Red Cross?
No, the Red Cross, the International Red Cross in the West Bank, what they can do after 4 months and somebody has been in prison or held for 4 months, they can help to provide a visitor's permit after 4 months.
Now, are they granted those visitors' permits, or are they obstructed in any way, or is it routine?
Well, it's not like the whole family. It could be, for instance, an elderly mother who gets the permission or something like that. Rarely a whole family.
Okay. But as far as when the Red Cross seeks permission to visit them, how long does it take the Red Cross to get a permit?
Well, it's the standard procedure. After 4 months, you can apply for these permits to visit. And you don't receive them before 4 months.
Okay, and I guess what I'm getting at is the Red Cross, is it easier for the Red Cross to access? The point I'm getting at is one of the things we're getting in the media here is the horrific manner that the Palestinians are holding this soldier and denying him access to the Red Cross. And I'm constantly having it pointed out to me that the Israelis treat their prisoners so much more humanely and that they get full Red Cross access, et cetera. And I'm just trying to see if that can be confirmed or not, because...
Not full Red Cross access. For instance, there are... I've spoken to parents whose son would be in prison, and for instance, one family, the mother said that the son is suffering from asthma, and he needs his asthma medication, and the Red Cross cannot access or to provide to help him to see a doctor or to get the medication he needs and so forth. Also, what they say that the water is usually so poor quality that people also suffer from the bad water. Skin rashes and things like that seem to be very common.
Now, as a licensed psychoanalyst and psychologist, I'm guessing you actually treat people who have been traumatized. Is there any particular aspect of treating the Palestinian population in Hebron that you find different from treating other populations?
Yes. Before I went to Palestine, both here in Sweden and in Britain, I have worked with people, with refugees who have been traumatized by wars and even torture. But the difference is, for instance, if I would want to label the suffering with something, it might be post-traumatic stress disorder, which in Palestine I feel is inaccurate because firstly it's not post, it's an ongoing trauma. And I'm not sure it's a disorder either because it's, maybe... I would prefer to see it as maybe a normal response to an abnormal situation. And the difference would be that it's ongoing. For instance, if I'm seeing somebody who has been released from prison, or there has been a violent incursion to the home or to the house, something like that, I cannot say it's in the past because they will likely come back. If not next week, maybe next month or something like that. So it's ongoing. And this is the difference, I think.
So instead of helping them heal from a trauma, you're trying to help them cope with ongoing trauma?
I think that's the best we can do.
Now, yeah. In your experience as a psychoanalyst and a psychologist, what is the long-range impact on a population's behavior, on an individual's behavior, under this kind of repeated trauma? What's the likely...
Since there are so many young boys arrested and imprisoned, and I haven't heard a lot of physical... torture with for children, but there is psychological torture, and they are threatened, for instance, with rape or things like that, threatened so they will confess to anything. And these confessions they sign are in Hebrew, which they don't understand. So they will confess to anything in front of these threats. And I see I'm not sure that the IDF, the Israeli forces, would agree to this, but it looks like to me, as a foreigner there anyway, that the young boys are a target. And what happens when children are arrested in the middle of the night is that it breaks the parents. And if you break the parents, you will break eventually the whole society, the fabric of the society. So I can see this psychological warfare by keeping arresting again and again these young boys, children, are detrimental for the society as a whole. On an individual level, also detrimental, of course, for the children. And their opportunity to education, for instance, their opportunity to grow, well, they don't have the opportunity to grow up in a safe community. It's as simple as that.
Okay, now, long-range effects on their behavior. Like, I understand that the suicide bombers grew up under occupation. They grew up with this kind of trauma daily. In your opinion, as a professional, is there a connection between the treatment, the trauma, and the decision to take such an action?
No. We have to keep in mind that there haven't been a suicide bombing for quite some time. So it's not something that is going on now. A few years back there were suicide bombers, but not now, since a few years back. But what you can say, for instance, if I'm talking about teenage boys who have been in prison, they have been physically, psychologically mistreated or even tortured. What you can see that some come out they come out, of course, very angry. And the question is where they want to direct their anger, towards others or towards themselves. So many of these young boys obviously come up very, very angry. But what I have seen, it's not taken out to the Israelis. It's because it's not possible. It's not possible to take it out on the Israeli soldiers. So what they do is that they have anger tantrums in their homes when they get back out. They lose all their friends because of people are suspicious about collaborators. They have this bad temper and so on and so on. So they come out and become quite isolated, most of them.
Okay. Now, a prognosis for, because again, as you said, this is an entire population experiencing ongoing trauma. Should we reach a point where there is peace and the daily trauma is removed, do you think, considering the extent of the traumas, that they will ever be able to heal?
I think so. I mean, human beings have an extraordinary ability to heal, but I think, say that if the settlers would leave, if the military would leave, and if there was a free Palestine, at some point I think they will have a lot of work to do to heal, because it won't happen just because the military would leave. So people are so traumatized that it will take some time. But I also need to say that at the same time, I can see that people have, at least in Palestine, people have an extraordinary ability to also to move on with life. Because, I mean, there is also a daily life going on beyond this military, beyond the incursions and the land grabbing and the water thefts and all of that. I mean, people fall in love, people start families, people laugh. There is also a lot of laughter and happiness at the same time as these disasters are happening. So, yeah, I think As a population, of course, it will take time, but for sure, I believe that they will heal.
Now, I know you didn't work directly with Palestinians in the diaspora, but again, you and I have discussed this in the past, that the impact of the Israeli actions, not just within Palestine, but outside Palestine, extrajudicial executions, this is what they call assassination, the kidnapping, the recent kidnapping of the engineer from another sovereign nation instead of going through a extradition process. As a psychologist, do you believe that this has the power to impact Palestinians throughout the diaspora as well as those directly under occupation?
I think Palestinians, wherever they are, I mean, if they are in the diaspora, wherever they are, they suffer and they follow very closely what's going on in Palestine. And even if they are not directly affected, for instance, Palestinians who, if they live in Sweden and there are no incursions, we don't see the military on the roads or things like that, it of course it's affecting them.
Okay. First of all, part of the reason we're doing this interview is this is something that's important to you. Is there a message that you want to get out to our listeners regarding what you have witnessed and what you have seen?
I have seen an extreme level of violence against the whole population. And what can I say? The message should be that international law should apply even in the Middle East. The settlements are illegal according to international law. There is no discussion or debate about that. They are illegal. And I think if the international community could see to that international law was upheld even by Israel, I think the conflict will be solved.
So, okay.
Yeah.
I'll go ahead and finish.
No, that's it.
Well, I was going to address that more specifically. The Palestinians are going before the UN in September to ask for official recognition. If you were to speak to the UN on behalf of the Palestinians, what would you tell them?
I would tell them that, as far as I know, anyway, this is the longest ongoing occupation we have heard of. This the West Bank is occupied since 1967. So you can imagine there are people who are now like 40, 50 years have never really experienced freedom. They have grown up with this occupation. And I think I would say that we have a law according to the Geneva Convention. Moving your own population to a territory that you occupy is illegal. And it has to be, that law has to be applied even to Israel. So the settlements has to go. They have to go. The occupiers need to leave. And Palestine should be free. And also what we are talking about is, I've seen in the media a lot of times that Hamas or Palestine, Hamas especially, wish to wipe Israel off the map. But if you look at the map, how the map has changed since 1948, we can see who is wiping who off the map. And it's for sure not Israel who is wiped off. It's the opposite. It's Palestine that is being wiped off the map. And I would also like to say that it's actually not about Israel's right to exist. What I would like to address is Palestine's right to exist. And Palestinians' right to health care, their right to education, and the right to live without fear. It should be pretty basic, I think.
Okay, now, beyond that, like I said, this has been an ongoing occupation for many, many decades. The world largely has sat silent. Most nations, even though they say that they support Palestine and recognize Palestine, do not take actions against Israel. And I'm not talking about attacking Israel or bombing Israel. That just, you know, continues the cycle. But to impose the same kind of sanctions on Israel that they would impose on anyone else that was in so many violations of international of the Geneva Conventions. Is this something that you would see as being effective, given what you know of the Israelis, or is this just something they would shrug off, so not worth the effort? Because I'm wondering why no one does this. Individuals call for boycotts, but nations haven't.
Nations have. But what happened? But you know what happens in the Security Council, because it's there that things are decided. Yeah. And you know that any slight criticism against Israel will be vetoed by US and the UK. This is why. And the rest of the international community seems very toothless when it comes to taking another standpoint.
Do you believe that recognition before the UN would encourage nations that would be willing to do that, to follow up with action? I'm trying to figure out what the Israelis fear about what's going on in the UN.
Well, I'm not sure about that. What I know and what I see is that Israel is able to uphold this occupation thanks to the support in the UN and monetary and military, or should I say weapon support, from the US. I think that is what it takes, that the US will have to stop supporting it.
Okay. I'm, as an American citizen and as ashamed as I am of my government's position on this, I don't foresee that happening. Our president has already announced that he would veto any action in the Security Council. Mm-hmm. And that we will always stand with Israel. Why is something else I don't understand. Now, the other thing that we frequently hear is the emphasis on trying to make this about Muslim terrorism, that the Palestinians are engaged in the same kind of Muslim terrorism that you see with Al-Qaeda. I'm aware of the fact that 20% of the Palestinians are in fact Christians, so that's irrelevant, and that the Christians are just as involved in the resistance as are the Muslim Palestinians. Now, and I'm also aware that Hebron area is largely Muslim. Did you encounter various groups within the population, or were you confined entirely to Hebron?
No, in our work, we travel. I travel all over the Hebron Governorate, which is from, you could say, just south of Jerusalem to the separation wall in the south. So I traveled a lot, and in my work, I was also able to take a walk in Hebron. And I have to say, I never felt afraid among Palestinians. Never. What actually scared me were the IDF soldiers and the settlers. They are scary, so you have to stay away from them. But among Palestinians, I was never afraid.
Okay.
And this is a play with words, because, I mean, you have to consider that West Bank, Palestine, is occupied. by military and by illegal settlements. And labeling people who resist the occupation as terrorists, well, maybe to say it's a play with words is too kind, but it's dishonest, actually. What happens is, for instance, these incursions, calling people out in the middle of the night and arresting men and boys in the family. That's one side of the story. But the other side of the story is also that the family can be evicted. And the next morning you can have the house full of either Israeli soldiers or even Israeli family. And the Israeli flag flying on the roof. So actually to, you know, send out the military, evict the family from their home, and another family moves in. And if people would like to defend the family and the home, and then to label them as terrorists is a bit rich to me, actually.
Well, and here's the thing I'm trying to clarify. In your observation, was there any difference in the treatment of Palestinian Christians and Palestinian Muslims? Was there any difference in response to the trauma from Palestinian Christians and Palestinian Muslims? Again, we here in the West, there are many that are trying to make this about Judaism versus Islam in Palestine and not about occupation, not about the taking of land. They're trying to divert it into a religious debate. And they completely leave Christian Palestinians out of the equation. And if they do come up, they say, oh, no, Christians are treated well.
I can't answer that question, really, because, you know, Hebron, in Hebron are Palestinians, they are Muslim. The Christian Palestinians, I think they live more in the Bethlehem area, where I did not work. So I don't think I met the Christian Palestinian actually in Hebron or Hebron Covenant, so I can't answer your question.
Okay, well, I appreciate your honesty and not filling in blanks that you don't have familiarity with. I'm not sure where to take this from here because, you know, again, we hear denials of the kinds of things I were an eyewitness to. Here in the West, when it does get through, they say, no, the Palestinians, it's just propaganda. Even the video, because I understand there's peace groups within Israel that have provided video cameras to the Palestinians to video the kind of actions you've described. Mm-hmm. But when these videos do make it to the West, we're told they're doctored, that, you know, anybody can make anything on film and make it look like anything.
Well, you know, there are some 40 NGOs working on the West Bank. Doctors Without Borders is one out of about 40. You have Save the Children, you have SOS Children Villages, you have, lots of others. And there is, in Hebron, since the shooting in Abraham Mosque in 96, I think it was, there was in the mosque on Friday prayers, there was somebody entering and killed, I think, 29 people or something like that.
You're referring to Barak Goldstein.
Yes. And since then, it was decided, it was an agreement between Israelis and the Palestinians that there should be an independent group of observers in Hebron. And they have been there since 1996, and they are still there today. There should be six people from six nations. There are Norway, Denmark, Sweden, Switzerland, Italy, and Turkey. And they are observers. And if you are in Hebron, you see the cars. They are moving in Hebron, also in the old city of Hebron, where there is a lot of tensions, because there in the old city of Hebron is where the settlers in Hebron are. They are documenting, they are taking pictures, they are video filming, and they are reporting both to Palestinian and Israeli authorities. But they don't take it from there, because then they are classified. So, I mean, they have lots of evidence about what's going on. But they are not allowed to show it to the world.
Why would they not be allowed to show it to the world? This needs to be before the UN.
I think that was one of the conditions, because it's called the Temporary Presence in Hebron, TIPH, Temporary International Presence in Hebron, TIPH. And I think they have... what's the word? They are act as a deterrent. Their presence is actually like a deterrent. So when they show up in their cars, or they speak to people, or if there is an incursion or a house demolition order handed out or something like that, they get to know about it and they go. And they might be able to cool things down a bit, maybe to delay it a bit. To see that maybe if they are there, things don't get out of hand, or how, what do you want to call it? But they are not allowed to act, they only observe. And so Palestinians say they are useless because they don't do anything, they just observe. And the Israelis say that they are useless because they are in the way. But the video films and the photographs and the reports and everything that goes to the Palestinian authorities and Israeli authorities, they stay there. And there's a lot of evidence. But for the future, I would say, for the future.
So that someday that the Palestinians and the, what they're stating about the brutality of the occupation can be validated, if even if no one believes them now, they still accept that that's a possibility for the future.
Yeah, that's it.
Oh.
And this international presence in Hebron, they sit on a lot of material and evidence about the atrocities and crimes that are committed against Palestinians.
Okay, I'm guessing crimes by the settlers, but would the crimes go beyond just individual civilian crimes from the settlers, the crimes of the military itself?
Yeah, both. Both. I think, they are in the area, and as I said, in the old city of Hebron, which, by the way, is a very beautiful place, the old city, where you have, but completely sealed off. So, I mean, to get into the old city of Hebron, you have to have a permission from the Israeli authorities, which means, or get out or in. So if you happen to be a Palestinian living in the old city, you are basically stuck there. Difficult to get education, difficult to get to hospital if you need and so forth. Difficult for us to, for Doctors Without Borders or anyone else to get there. You need the permission to go, which you might have, but you will have to spend a lot of time waiting at the checkpoints for them to open for you. But
okay.
But this international group, observers in Hebron, they are collecting data about what's going on. So it's there, all right, even if it's not presented to the UN or to the world or anyone else, just to the Palestinian and Israeli authorities.
Okay, I have a question from a listener, from Mike in California. Do you feel that Israel is similar in its atrocities towards the Palestinians as Nazi Germany? I've heard this comparison made many times and, of course, get screaming responses.
I've heard it. Yes, I heard it too. I don't know what to say about that, really. I mean, there is obviously... you have, it's for sure Israel is an apartheid state. You have the apartheid wall, the separation wall. You have different laws, different strokes for different folks, even if you are an Israeli citizen, Arab, Palestinian, Israeli citizen, you will be treated differently. In that sense, you could say that there are some similarities. You can also say that there are some similarities, maybe, in the confiscation of Palestinian properties, land and property. Beyond that, I think it's a very difficult question to answer, really. Maybe because it's such a horrible thought.
Yeah, it is a fairly horrible thought, and that the oppressed has become the oppressor.
Yeah.
But in fact, the majority of the Israelis are not, they were born either after Nazi Germany, or a good many of them were born outside of the areas affected by Nazi Germany, like the settlers from the USA.
Mm.
Most American Jews were not in Nazi Germany and didn't experience that, so they don't have the oppressed becoming oppressor type psychology going on. It's and then because the argument I always get back when I hear that comment made or I see the response is that, well, we haven't fired up we don't have gas chambers, we don't have ovens. And my concern is that what the world is waiting for? That until they actually go as far as creating gas chambers and ovens, we do nothing?
Yeah, it's a thought, and it's a horrible thought. I mean, you could say, and I think it's really fair enough to say that the oppressed have become the oppressors. I think that's fair enough.
Okay. Now, I have one questioner that is going into a bit of a diversion because of recent events in Scandinavia. And the connect, like I said, there's been a huge effort, a push to make the Palestine issue a part of the overall war against Islamic terror, which, again, I feel is a play with words as well, but trying to unhitch that. But I'm not being successful given this question from Samantha in Chicago. How do the people in Scandinavia, you're in Sweden, react to the shootings and bombing in Norway? Is this affecting Muslims or Arab immigrants in your area that you have seen or observed?
I think what I see here is that Swedes react the same way as Norwegians do. These kind of right-wing Zionists, these kind of talk against horrible terrorist Muslims, we need to address it. We need to answer back. And not allowing this actually propaganda, Zionist right-wing propaganda going on without us answering to it. And also, I mean, it's ludicrous. I mean, Sweden, for instance, we have many more people who are from the from Muslim countries here, living here now, than they have in Norway. But it's actually ludicrous that this small minority, because it's still a small minority, that they would be taking over, or that they are terrorists or whatever. They have fled. They have fled terror. Yeah. And the terror that they are experiencing are often instigated, I must say, by the West. So I think most people here react as Norwegians do. We are appalled by this kind of right-wing Zionist And I mean, you hear this rhetoric now and then, also here in Sweden, this kind of horrible terrorist Muslims. So for me, it's a matter of how big a step is it from words to action? Yeah. For this Norwegian guy, his words and actions were the same. And this is what we have to make sure that it doesn't happen again. It must not happen again. And as in Norway, Sweden is also an open society, and we would like to keep our open societies without any terrorist or, I don't know, patriot acts or whatever.
Well, the argument is against multiculturalism, so that Sweden, I have understood, has always been an open society, a very fair-minded society. You've maintained neutrality in many periods of history when everybody else was in the thick of it.
Mm. Well, I mean, on a legal basis or according to our constitution, we are neutral, which doesn't mean that we are not allowed to voice an opinion in conflict. We can take a stand, but we are not supposed to fight wars. We strongly believe in differences. You have to solve differences with words, not with bombs or guns.
And you've worked closely with the results of trying to solve a difference with bombs and guns. And the fact is that it would seem that Palestine-Israel conflict is a glaring example of why that doesn't work. They've been trying to solve that problem for over 60 years with bombs and guns, and here we are now.
Semantics here. The conflict is about land grab and people who are losing land trying to defend the land and their families. And that is exactly what the conflict is about. It's about taking land. For instance, I can say that during the settlement freeze that ended I think late September last year, Israel had promised not to expand settlements, but they chose to interpret the freeze or the agreement that they were not building new settlements, which they supposedly didn't do, but they expanded already existing ones. I saw that, I witnessed that. And I mean, the very same day that the settlement freeze ended, you could also see the movement on the roads with the building material, new settlements were coming up. So it's about land grab and another people trying to defend their land and their livelihood.
Yeah, we've also heard of the destroying of the olive orchards, the destroying of the means of supporting themselves.
Yeah.
As part of the routine. And I understand olive trees can live for 1,000 years.
Yeah.
And these orchards have been...
It takes 20 seconds with a chainsaw to take them down. Yeah.
But, a 1,000-year-old olive tree that's been in the same family for hundreds of years, there's that, even though most people would see that as an inanimate object and not having the same impact as the damage done to humans, that's part of the damage being done to the humans.
Yeah. I mean, the olive tree is the backbone of Palestine. Very important.
Okay, well, we're coming up on the end of the hour here, Gudrun. I so much appreciate you taking the time and staying up, because for the people listening, it's 3 a.m. in Sweden right now.
Actually, it's 4 a.m.
It's 4 a.m. We started at 3 a.m.
Yeah.
So we greatly appreciate your time to be with us. if you got any last thing you'd like to say to the audience before I close up here.
Well, the information is out there. And of course, you have to be very careful with not believing the first source of information. But the information is out there, and you have to make it your own mind up. If it's difficult, why don't you go and visit? Hebron is a nice place to be among the Palestinians.
Okay.
Besides that, I can say that it was my pleasure to be with you tonight.
And I do appreciate it. And again, I thank you for sharing your experience with us and helping to deepen our understanding of the effects of events that, in fact, are impacting all of our nations. And they'll continue to impact us all as long as the occupation of Palestine continues. For my audience, please join Bassima Farhat when she returns as host next week with Amy Wright, former career military officer and diplomat, now active in the anti-war movement, on the People Speak show on BBS Radio, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Good night.
One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of the sea, by the relief office, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.